Mike, welcome to the African American Athlete Show. You're on with Ricky Hampton and Michael Robinson. Mike, thank you so much for checking in with us this evening. And first and foremost, congratulations to you on your induction into the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame. I had the pleasure of being up there to support my good friend, Coach Ray Scott, who's a great friend of this show. And got a chance to meet you, Mike. Congratulations on that. And what kind of honor is that for a Philly kid to go into that esteem hall?
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate the recognition. It was a great honor for me, especially going in with somebody like Ray, who I looked up to when I was coming up in Philly as somebody to emulate. But when you look at the long list of Philly sports legends that are in that hall, to join them and be viewed as an equal or a member of that club was a tremendous honor and very humbling for me.
Absolutely.
So, Mike,
start off, Mike.
Yeah, so, Mike, what was it like to end your NBA portion of your career back at your hometown Philly 76ers? What was that like? And then, of course, you were a year early before they won a championship with Moses, but what was that scenario like?
Yeah, it was great because, you know, you very often in the NBA, especially with the draft and everything, you don't have a choice as to where you get to play. So I was fortunate to be drafted in the first round by the Phoenix Suns, but it was a time that, you know, they were struggling to get to rise up in the league. You know, they had missed out on the number one pick, and instead of getting Kareem, they got Neil Walk. So, you know, we were a very mediocre team. Then I went to an average team in Seattle. Then I went to a very bad team with the Nets. And then I went to a team in Indiana where they had just come in from the ABA, and we struggled for a couple years. And then the final year there, we made the playoffs for the first time. But then to get traded to Philadelphia, which was my home team, but was also my hometown, but was also an elite team where, you know, we won over 60 games. It was like every night, it was like a rock star appearance with Julius Erving and Daryl Dawkins and Maurice Cheeks and, you know, guys like that. It was a thrill. I mean, we knew we were going to win almost every night. And then we went to the finals where we played against Magic and Kareem. And so it was like a great, great ending to my career, even though I didn't know at the time it was going to be my last year in the NBA. Circumstances, free agency, and then a great offer to go play in the Italian league in Europe kind of made it like the end of my NBA portion of my basketball career. So it all worked out great. I had a great time playing in the league and to finish up with playing with, you know, one of the greatest players in the history of the game, and with Julius and participating in the finals was a great ending for me.
All right.
And Mike, you left out with the opportunity to play with Doc. And when you came into the league with the Suns, you had an opportunity to play with Connie Hawkins. And could you tell us a little bit about the great Connie Hawkins, who recently passed away, the kind of player he was?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I didn't get to play with Connie very long because early in the season or even the preseason, I'm not sure, they traded him to the Lakers. But I got to tell you that just the short time, the month or two that I ended up being around Connie and Charlie Scott, he was just a great human being. He just welcomed me and treated me like so nice. And as a young kid coming into the league and being exposed to a legend like that and looking up to him for his basketball ability, to have him be so down to earth and so welcoming to me, he made me feel special. And I got the impression when I went to his funeral in Brooklyn a month ago or a couple weeks ago, he made everybody feel that way. So he was just a special guy, and not only was he a great basketball player, but he was a great human being, and I really treasure the short period of time that I had to play with him. I just I just regret the fact that, you know, they made a decision to send him to the Lakers, and I didn't get a chance to really play with him for a long period of time.
Yeah.
Well, Mike, backtracking to the infamous 1972 Olympics, Munich, West Germany, not only the devastation of losing that game on some weird circumstances, but you also had the terrorist situation going on. So how cognizant were you guys of what was going on with the Israeli athletes, and then what happened with you guys on the court when they gave the Soviet team like about six times to win the game?
Yeah, it was one of the most incredible experiences of my life, especially at that point since I was like 19 years old, 20 years old. So I hadn't experienced a whole lot. But, you know, unlike today's world, terrorist activities were not a part of the everyday life. In fact, I don't think we ever had too many up to that time. And so when we woke up one morning and were told that somebody had been killed the night before, and there were armed guards all around the Israeli residence, which was right across a courtyard from where we were staying, we didn't quite know how to position that. You know, a lot of us coming from backgrounds where we came from, it's not unusual to hear about a homicide here or there or somebody getting killed the night before, but we didn't quite know why or how or what the circumstances were. And there wasn't television and radio for us to tune into. And they tried to shield us from it. So they took us away from the complex and kept us at an army base the whole day where we usually practice, but instead of coming back during the day, we stayed there the whole day. And then when we did come back, we found out that they were now transporting the terrorists and the hostages out of the Olympic Village in helicopters to the airport. And we saw the helicopters leave the Olympic Village as we were returning. And when we got back to our rooms, we were able to tune in and call home, and people at home were following this on television, and they were able to fill us in on the fact that, you know, the hostages had been kidnapped and that at the airport they were in fact assaulted and murdered. And so it was really a troubling and incredible situation that we were going through. And we really wrestled with the fact because we hadn't started the medal round yet. I think we had just finished the pool play, and we were about to start playing for the medals. And we really wondered and questioned whether or not we should stay there and play or whether we should try to get home and be safe. But I think as a committee, the U.S. Olympic Committee decided that we weren't going to let the terrorists dictate how the games were going to go, and we all decided to stay there and play. So we ended up playing, and I think we beat Cuba in the semifinal round, and then we went on to play the Russians. And even though we struggled for the entire game because we were so young and they were a very veteran team full of, adult players who were used to playing in international competition and playing in professional leagues throughout the Europe, a lot of these guys, the Belofs, for example, were our FIBA Hall of Famers. We didn't know this at the time because we were kids, but they were all older guys, experienced guys, and they did a pretty good job of dictating the tempo of the game. But at the end of the day, you know, we rallied at the end, and we pulled it out, and we finished the game up by 1 point based on two very critical free throws by Doug Collins. But the head of the FIBA Association, who was also from a communist country, came down and told the scorekeepers that they needed to put 3 seconds back on the clock in order to facilitate the last 3 seconds that they had tried to score on and were unsuccessful. And they tried it again, and it didn't work, and he made them do it again. And so on the third time, they were able to get away with a foul, pushing off one of our defenders and able to score. And at that point, they told us that the game was over and that, you know, the Russians had won. We protested the game based on some legitimate protest of 4 or 5 rules that had been broken. But based on the 5 people who were on the panel that we protested to, The three communist countries voted in favor of Russia. The two non-communist countries voted that the rules that were violated should dictate that that game should not be decided the way it was. But the decision was decided 3-2, and they decided that we were silver medalists and the Russians were gold medalists. And we didn't agree with that decision, and we didn't accept those silver medals, and we haven't until this day.
Wow.
And those medals are still sitting somewhere, aren't they, Mike?
Yeah, I just saw a guy from FIBA not too long ago at one of our NBA events, and he told me that those medals are still sitting in FIBA's vault in Switzerland. And he jokingly asked me if I wanted mine, and I told him when they were ready to give me my gold medal, I'd be happy to accept it. But that silver medal, they could give that to whoever they want, because that wasn't what we won.
Wow.
I don't blame you one bit, man. You know, I had the pleasure of covering Doug when he was the head coach here in Detroit with the Pistons. And if you ever wanted to get him in a bad mood, all you had to do was bring up the 72 Olympics. I mean, that still sticks in his craw today. I'm sure you've gotten over it, but I'm sure you understand the anger that can bring in a guy like Doug.
Oh, yeah.
It's not really anger, but frustration.
He's an emotional guy to begin with. And like you said, if you ever really push him over the edge, bring that up or talk about accepting those medals. Because, listen, he laid his heart out on that game, on that floor, and all of us did. I mean, we played – we worked so hard. I mean, the preparation for that Olympic those Olympic games is nothing like what our NBA guys go through now. You know, they go to Vegas, they stay at the Wynn, they practice for a couple weeks. You know, we went to Pearl Harbor. We worked out three times a day for a month. I mean, we toiled and sweated like soldiers in the Army until we got over there. And then we busted our butts to win it, and then they stole it from us. And it was so obvious, especially after the protest, that it was a political decision rather than, you know, what was right. And so it was just nothing. It was just something that, and like I said before, we were all very young. So it was the first time in my life that I realized that things aren't always fair in life. You know, like the good guys don't always win. And they just took it from us and said, you know, accept it. So, you know, we accepted it because I've always told people that, you know, if losing a basketball game is the worst thing that ever happened to me in my life, then I've lived a blessed life. And so I don't dwell on it. I've had a lot of great things happen to me before and after that. So, you know, my life has been very blessed. But you don't forget the fact that it was something that you work for and you earn. And every 4 years, it comes up. You know, you see people how happy they are to win a gold medal, and you know you should be one of those people. You should have that gold medal to commemorate that experience. But it was taken from us, and Doug and every one of us unanimously voted that we were not going to accept that silver medal.
Yeah. So, Mike, thinking, every time you do an interview like this one tonight, some guy got to bring it up. So
they always do.
But you know what? You know what, Mike? Though, but while you were doing your career, you figured in the next 4 years, they almost lose to Puerto Rico with Butch Lee, one man show, almost beat them, but they managed to win the gold medal. Then you get the boycott. So Isaiah Thomas and Magic and all those guys, well, Magic was already gone, but Isaiah Thomas and Rolando Blackman, all those guys couldn't play. Then 84, Michael Jordan and those guys just take care of business. But then 88, they actually lose once again to the Russians. And that's when everything changed. And we're going to get the NBA players now. So when you saw that happening, what was your thought process, especially to see them lose to the Russians in 88?
Well, you know, I thought it was something that needed to happen because after going through my experience and then also after going to Europe and playing in Europe, I played in Italy for 7 years. So I saw that there were legitimate professional leagues over there. And these guys played in these professional leagues. And then every summer they went back and played for the national teams. And the United States was operating under a different set of rules. you know, our pros weren't allowed to play for the national teams, and only our college
right.
players were allowed to play. So mm-hmm. with the advance of basketball around the world and how all the other teams were getting better, all the nations were getting better at playing this sport, it just wasn't fair to have a group of 18, 19-year-old kids get together for a couple of weeks and then go over and play against 27, 28, 30-year-old professionals who play every year together as a national team and expect them to win. We were able to do that for a number of years because we were so far ahead of all the other countries in playing basketball that it didn't matter. But at some point, it kind of caught up to us. And mm-hmm. it was impossible because even the strength factor, the physical factor of a 17-year-old, 18-year-old playing against a 30-year-old man is a disadvantage. And when you talk about the fact that these guys play professional all year long, every summer they come together as a team, so they have a lot of continuity. And then you've got 12 kids from 12 different colleges coming together to go over there and try to beat them. So I think what happened was when they changed the rules and made it eligible for all professionals to play for their national team, and so that allowed our USA players to play. Then you had the dream team. Now you got all professionals in there because those guys playing for Russia, for Yugoslavia, and for all those other teams, they're pros too. They have been pros. So now you got our pros against their pros. So now it's an even slate, and now you got to catch up to that. Now they're trying to catch up to where our pros are. So I think it just took away some of the facade that it was all amateurs playing against amateurs because Sergey Belov, who dominated in our game, that guy had been playing in the Russian professional league for 10 years. He played in three Olympics before he played against us. All of us were coming out of college playing in our first international competition. So at that point, we still were able to beat him. But I think as time went on and as the game progressed, you know, that gap closed a little bit, especially when you're talking about our kids against their men. And so the rule change, I think, actually cleared all that out the way, and now it's made it an even playing field for everybody. So now we've established once again how dominant we play this game in this league, and everybody else is behind, and they got to catch up. And someday maybe they will. I don't know. I doubt it. But, you know, at least there's no more kids against boys. Kids against men.
Let me get everybody caught up and listening to the African American Athlete Talk Show with Ricky Hampton and Michael Robinson. Our guest for this first half hour is Mike Bantam, the head of officiating in the National Basketball Association, former NBA player, former Olympian. Mike, one of the things I was so impressed with, and by the way, we're going to be letting Mike go in a few minutes. We're going to be joined by Coach Bill Thomas, the former head football coach at Tennessee State University and Texas Southern University. We're going to discuss the decision by Hampton University to leave the historically black MEAC conference and head to the Big South Conference. But, Mike, I wanted to ask about your transition from professional basketball to the corporate side of basketball. As director of NBA operations, was that something you were thinking about on the corporate level as you played the game? How did that all transpire?
Well, it kind of happened organically because it wasn't something that I strived for or thought about, but I did have the presence of mind and the parental guidance from my mother when I was young. And in school to really focus on studying and getting my degree because I never really felt I was a late bloomer as a basketball player. I didn't play varsity basketball until I was a senior. And then once I got scholarship offers, I wasn't really thinking about being a pro. So I really felt that this opportunity to go to college was something I needed to take advantage of. So I tried to make sure I got a degree, and I got a degree in marketing. Then I was fortunate enough to be drafted, and between the NBA and years in Italy, I had a 16-year career. So I played for a long time, and then at the end, when I was 39 years old, almost 40, I had to transition. So I was trying to think about what I was going to do, and I had a marketing degree, and my years in Europe, I was able to witness how the NBA was really starting to market itself internationally. I saw from year to year how their efforts were growing in Europe. And so I felt like with my basketball experience, my degree in marketing, and now my experience living in Europe and having language skills that I developed over there, that doing international marketing for basketball would be a great fit for me. So I reached out to Commissioner David Stern. He agreed that I could be an asset for the company. And so he hired me in international marketing. And I did that for a number of years as a member of the NBA International Marketing Group. And over the years, I've transitioned to a number of jobs. I spent some years in Europe in our European office growing the game and growing the brand in Europe. Then I moved to the player development side where I worked with all of our players for 12 years on their off-the-court transition and also their transition into the league, the rookie transition program, and all of their off-the-court educational stuff. And then for the last 4 years, I've moved into the referee operations department where I've overseen all aspects of our officiating program. So I've had a long career in the NBA, and I'm fortunate because when I was transitioning, I had the degree, I had a lot of experience in the game of basketball, and I couldn't have drawn up a better transition than to actually be able to work in the game that I was so passionate about, because that's what I think a lot of players struggle with when they finish playing is how do you find something that you're as passionate about as you were about playing the game. And I was fortunate in that the marketing, the international part, the game all kind of came together for me, and I was able to get into the organization and exercise those assets and build a career out of it. So it's lasted a long time. I feel like I've never really had a job because I've continued to stay in the game of basketball from the time I went to college. And it's been very good for me and my family.
Mike, speaking of when you played in Italy and, of course, learned the language, which I think is awesome, but did you ever cross paths with Jelly Bean or any other NBA players that were playing in Italy?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We were a very close-knit community over there because at the time, I mean, the rules have changed a little bit now, but at the time when we were going over there, all the Italian teams and other teams in the Spanish league, Greek teams, whatever, they only were allowed to have two foreigners. And most of the teams always opted for American players. There were a few that went for European players. And then, of course, Oscar Schmidt from Brazil was a longtime star in the Italian league. So there were a few teams that had other foreigners on their team. But the other teams all went for Americans. And also, at the time that I went over there, there was a shift in their mentality because before that, they were always drafting kids out of college who couldn't make it in the NBA. So you had a lot of guys that would go over there still trying to prove themselves and make a name for themselves. But that at the time I went, they were shifting to going after NBA veterans. So you had McAdoo, you had George Gervin, you had Jelly Bean, you had myself, you had Jim Brewer, you had Dwight Jones, you had, you know, a lot of guys who had 9, 10, 12-year careers. I mean, you know, George Gervin was one of the 50 greatest players. All these guys were now playing in the Italian league, and we were playing against each other. So as far as Joe was concerned, though, Joe and I actually – and what happened, too, was – we all played on the same day. So we'd play on Sunday. Sometimes there would be a Wednesday game, but every team had Monday off. So Monday, a lot of times Americans who live close to each other would get together and have their families get together because we missed each other. We missed being in America. We missed American things. So that was the closest we could get. And Joe and I lived only about 2 hours from each other. So we used to get together quite a bit and go to Rome and go to a McDonald's or go to a Wendy's or something so we could have a little taste of America. And I knew Kobe when he was like 5 years old and his sisters. And my kids knew, we all got together and we'd spend a day together and we'd have our little taste of America and then we'd go back to our Italian lives. So, yeah, I knew Joe actually came over the same year, same amount of time that I did. I spent 7 years there before I got a job with the NBA, but I think Joe actually spent a couple more than me and then went on and played maybe a year in France or something. And but, yeah, we spent a lot of our time together. He was in Rieti when I was in Rome, and Rieti and Rome is only 30 minutes from each other.
You're listening to the African American Athlete Radio Show with Ricky Hampton and Michael Robinson. Our guest is Mike Bantam, the head of officiating for the National Basketball Association. And we're going to be joined shortly by Coach Bill Thomas, the former head coach at Tennessee State and Texas Southern University. Mike, before I let you go, man, the NBA has been a leader in diversity, and I see how you have transitioned into the corporate world. What would you tell a young kid? I have a kid that I'm mentoring who's about to graduate law school at Ole Miss who desperately wants to continue being involved in athletics. How do kids break into the NBA or well, I'll just leave it with the NBA, being that that's your forte, coming out of college without having that actually played there on the corporate level?
Well, you know, playing on the floor really isn't that big of a requirement. I mean, we have over 1,000 employees in the NBA, and I would venture to say that, and I'm making a guess here because I'm not sure of how many people we have working internationally, but there's probably less than 10 former players in our organization. If you talk about almost any area of study or any area of profession, there is a place in sports for that, whether it's a lawyer or marketing or public relations, communications, IT, the internet, all the whole internet world. I mean, that's one of the biggest growing areas within our organization. All of those specialties, analytics, there's a place in professional sports for that. So you just have to become proficient in a particular area and be very aggressive in trying to integrate yourself into a sports league. The best way to do it, there are some direct entries into the NBA. There's internships, there's associate programs, but those spots are limited, and a lot of people can't get into those. But you can get into it with your local teams. I mean, we got 30 teams across the league. We got almost 30 G League teams, which is a development area for every area of our business, not just for players, but for coaches, for PR people, everybody. All those jobs are available at all of those different levels. And a lot of times the way to get in is to volunteer and be an intern and not be looking to get paid right off the bat or paid highly to start, but to get in, get the experience, make the connections, establish the network, build a reputation, and work your way up. Because like I said, there's 1,000 different employees, all pretty well paid at some of the higher levels, in all different areas that contribute to this league being successful. Like I said, there's only – in our New York office, there's only, I want to say, 4 former NBA players. Myself, Kiki Vandeweghe, Sharif Abdul-Rahim, Rory Sparrow.
Wow.
After that, I can't think of any offhand. I might be leaving somebody out. I hope not. But other than that, you know, everybody else is a regular person. So a lot of them played in college, though, because if you have the love for sport, a lot of times you want to stay in sports. And so, but that doesn't get you in. What gets you in is the knowledge that you have in a particular area that's able to translate to a successful business. So you've got to be able to be proficient and be aggressive and get yourself out there and establish some connections. And you know, I think that's the best advice I could give you.
Awesome. I mean, that is just so true. I think about the beginning of my sports writing career at the Nashville Banner. Man, I used to work for free on Saturday. I wasn't making nothing as it is. It's still going in on Saturdays working for free, but I looked at it as training. And, you know,
well,
33
years
later.
Well, I mean, I don't want to cut you off, but that's
okay.
The same way. When I reached out to David Stern, I told David, I said, listen, I'm a former player. I got NBA experience. I got connections over here in Europe. I have a degree in marketing, but I don't have any work experience. I've never worked in marketing. All I've done is play basketball. I said, but if you will hire me, you know, I'm willing to start at the bottom, but I don't want to work in a basketball capacity. I want to work in the business capacity, so I want to learn the NBA business. So he hired me, and he hired me at a mid-level, manager level, which is not very highly paid, and it was very kind of a struggle for a minute, you know, living in New York and trying to make it off of that salary. But fortunately, I had saved a little bit of money from my playing days, so I was able to get started and make a go of it. But a lot of times you have to sacrifice for what you want. So like you, I mean, like you said, you know, you work for free. Internships can sometimes don't pay a whole lot of money, but you meet people in the business and you learn the business from the inside. And then some of those people can help you, you know, rise up or get other connections that can help you advance. So a lot of times, you know, guys kind of sabotage themselves because they're looking to get paid right off the bat. Especially if you're a player or a former player, you know, you're used to making a certain amount of money and you think you need to make that kind of money. And when I was in player development, helping players transition from the game, I let them know you're not going to make the kind of money that you made as a player. You know, you need to, at least not off the bat. So if you haven't set yourself up to not need a job at the end of your playing career, you need to be able to network and work your way through the business system and work your way up that way. So, you know, it's different for everybody, but there's a way and there's a lot of opportunity there.
Well, listen, Mike, I really appreciate you taking some time out of your schedule to join us tonight. Man, there's so many more questions I have, but I'm not going to keep you late. I know Mike wouldn't want to keep you late, but we would like to invite you back at a later date so we can really get into some more basketball stuff with you. And once again, congratulations to you on your recent induction into the Philadelphia Sports Hall of Fame.
Well, guys, I appreciate it. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And anytime you want me to come back, just let me know. I'll be happy to speak with you.
All right. Yeah, thanks for the appearance.
All right, guys.
Thank you, Mike.
All right.
Yeah, all right. Bye.